worked through the consortium's director of operations, a South African. But whoever the director of the consortium was, Costas was sure he or she was in possession of a spigot that poured pure gold. As he sipped his coffee, the sliding glass door opened behind him, and a bearded man stepped through in a rush, passing two burly bodyguards. He stopped at the table. In English, Costopoulos said,
"Good morning, Stanislav. Hope you don't mind if I finish my breakfast. Sit. Take a few breaths. Calm down. Then tell me what's so important."
The younger man did as instructed. He even took a sip of pineapple juice, already poured in crystal, when the older man motioned towards it. But he rushed through the act, spilled a little down his chin, then hurriedly put the glass back on the table. He spoke with a Serbian accent, but the Greek talked to Serbs daily, so it wasn't difficult for him to understand.
"There has been a disruption in the pipeline."
Costas Costopoulos showed his displeasure with slightly sagging shoulders, but nothing more.
"Where?" "Mostar."
The Greek took a bite of yogurt, then said,
"General Babek and his Belgrade men."
"Yes, sir."
"Details?"
"Attacked last night. 7 men dead, including Babek."
The Greek sighed now while he buttered his croissant. He displayed a subdued countenance, though this was highly distressing news, to be sure. Still, he wouldn't let the Serbian see him react with the shock he felt.
"So, who is interfering with my business interests this time? The Turks again?"
"Belgrade doesn't know who ordered it, but they think they know who carried out the operation itself, and they believe this was not an attack on the way station, but simply an attack on the general."
The older man looked up from his croissant and said,
"Well, who is responsible?"
A pause.
"An individual known as the Gray Man."
Costopoulos cocked his head.
"An individual?"
"We have no information that he was acting in concert with others."
"One man? One man killed 7, including the general who has been hunted for a quarter century? That sounds like a tall tale."
Stanislav was a member of the Serbian Mafia, the Branjevo Partisans, and he served as his organization's link to the consortium that operated the pipeline. Costopoulos was the only contact in the consortium he had ever met, and that was by design. He said,
"Belgrade has interviewed both the surviving security force and the horse, sir. Everything points to it being one very skilled man. Belgrade seems to know him by his moniker, Gray Man. They said no one else could have done this."
Costopoulos looked down to the water at the gorgeous summer morning. He didn't believe the lone assassin theory and thought the Serbian mob was a bunch of fools for even suggesting it.
"The merchandise was undisturbed?"
"There were 24 items on site. One is missing."
"The missing item. What's her story?"
"Moldovan. The horrors say Babek was fucking her himself in another room when the gunman appeared. Nothing special about her. They don't know where she is. Security men never saw her leave. But they were fighting it out with this killer at the time."
After a nod and a bite into his croissant, the Greek said,
"Obviously you will close down that way station."
"Underway now, sir. The product is gone already. Moved on to the next stop."
"They are early for the next stop. We aren't set to pick them up on the coast for 3 days. That could pose problems."
"I'm sorry, sir. But there is nowhere in our area of influence we can put them."
"Banja Luka?"
"We are getting it ready now, but it won't be secure for a few more days. Moving the horse on west was the only thing we could do."
Costas let a little frustration show now.
"This will be costly. Time-consuming. Obstructive to our work. How, dear Stanislav, do we exact our revenge for this?"
"This Gray Man will be hard to find. He's probably already far from here."
Costopoulos shrugged.
"Assassins will come and go. Keep an ear out for him, and I'll tell the other directors in the pipeline to do the same. But he'll be long gone by now. So I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about revenge for the failures in your ranks."
After a pause, he added,
"The local constabulary there in Mostar was involved in protecting the operation. Is that correct?"
"Yes, sir. Our contact there is a police chief in Mostar, a man named Vukovic."
"I'd say he did a rather poor job. Do you agree?"
After a brief pause, the Serbian replied,
"Agreed."
"We will make an example of him. Something that will show the other pipeline way stations that we do not accept underperforming from those we compensate well to keep our systems functioning safely."
Stanislav looked uncomfortable for a moment. The Greek picked up on this.
"He's one of Belgrade's assets, and you don't want to kill him. Is that it?"
"He is well positioned. He has helped us with many..."
"I can move the pipeline out of Belgrade's area of influence. I can move the women via northern routes or south through the Mediterranean."
Stanislav said nothing.
"I want a pound of flesh for this debacle. You can either find yourself a new chief of police in this little shit town of Mostar, or you can find yourself another endeavor as profitable as what I offer you."
Stanislav sat up straighter.
"I'm sorry, sir, but it's not you offering us the work. It's your masters in the consortium."
Kostopoulos bristled at this, but fought any show of anger or insult. Instead, he said,
"I rule this area, and my opinion holds weight with the director of the consortium."
Stanislav kept his defiant posture.
"Then we ask you to contact him and request that he take no action on Vukovic. We have other needs for him in the area. If you are leaving Mostar anyway, why should you care if he's still working for us?"
Kostas let it go, but he had no plans to contact the director and no idea how to do so, even if he did want to. The Serbian left the Greek alone on his luxurious balcony and stepped back inside to head to the elevator, pulling a phone from his pocket as he did so. Kostas Kostopoulos did his best not to let his temper flare in his work. He always tried to retain a dispassionate approach. So many other traffickers were thugs, gangsters, criminals through and through. But the organization Kostopoulos worked for, though they used petty gangsters for their grunt work, was made up of businessmen and businesswomen, not thugs. They acquired, produced, transported, traded, and profited on a product. And the fact that the product they dealt in was human beings had been tamped down by years of incredibly positive balance sheets and a growth line unparalleled in any other legitimate industry since the dot-com boom 20 years earlier. Nobody in any position of authority in the endeavor thought of their product as people. They were resources, assets, merchandise. But despite the Greek's desire to remain unemotional about what happened, he recognized that the shuttering of one of his pipeline way stations would hurt the monthly flow of product west, and this would ultimately reflect poorly on him. Kostopoulos might have been a powerful regional director in one of the largest human trafficking organizations in the world, but he didn't call the shots. And his dispassion now was tempered by the fact that he knew that some extraordinarily powerful and dangerous individuals were going to be very unhappy with him when he told them of last night's events. He'd have to make a call now to obtain consortium approval to send assassins after this Vukovic, because Kostas Kostopoulos didn't make these decisions on his own. Jaco Verduren didn't like this part of his job, but it was not because he was squeamish or sensitive about murder. He'd killed before, many times. He'd killed in combat, and he'd killed in security contract work, and he'd even killed once in a street fight in Pretoria. But this, tonight, this kind of killing he felt was far beneath him. These weren't combatants. These were lambs at the slaughterhouse. He was the butcher, and there was no game in that. Still, he drove in the front passenger seat of the Mercedes G-Wagen as it motored north away from Los Angeles through Calabasas, west of the hills of the San Fernando Valley, checking his phone idly and thinking about the old days, back in the nation of his birth, back in his time in South Africa's military and intelligence services. Those had been interesting times, so unlike tonight. Tonight, he would put bullets into the heads of two young women, dump their bodies in a ditch, and then turn around to head to Van Nuys Airport for a flight to Europe. The girls were all but unconscious in the back seat of the Mercedes. They'd been injected with heroin, not for the first time, and then they'd been helped out of the large property where they had been kept, folded into the SUV, and joined by Jaco Verdoorn and two of his men. Their heads lolled in the back with the bouncing on the roads, and Verdoorn showed his boredom with a wide yawn. This was just another day at the office. The driver stopped beside a ravine that ran along Big Pines Highway. This wasn't a particularly out-of-the-way location, but it was the middle of the night now, and there were no cars in sight, and anyway, this would just take a moment. The young women, one was a 19-year-old brunette from Belarus, and the other a 17-year-old Indonesian, were barely aware of their surroundings as they were let out onto the street, over to the shoulder, and up to a low metal railing. The two young women faced the ravine, both only now feeling a hint of confusion, because during their months of captivity, they'd never been out of the compound they were kept in, they'd never been in a car, and none of this felt exactly right. The Belarusian muttered through a tongue slurred with the drug injected into her.
"What is happening?"
The South African climbed out of the front passenger seat, pocketed his phone with a sigh, and then drew the Sig Sauer P220 pistol from the waistband of his khakis under his too-tight white polo shirt. As he leveled it at the back of the brunette's head, he said,
"The director grew tired of you, like he always does. Time to make way for the next shipment."
A gunshot rang out on the quiet hillside, and the young woman pitched forward, disappearing from view before the echo of the pistol's report made its way back from the other side of the ravine. The Indonesian, even in her drug-induced stupor, recoiled from the loud noise, and she started to turn around, but Jaco Verdoorn fired again, striking her in the left temple, and she, too, tumbled over the metal railing and down into the thick brush. One of the other South Africans shined his tactical flashlight down the ravine. A cloud of dust rose, indicating the women had come to rest on the earthen floor. Verdoorn had already holstered his pistol and sat back down in the SUV by the time the light clicked off and the two other men returned to the vehicle. This wasn't the first time Jaco had done this. This wasn't even the 10th time, and he expected in a couple of months, certainly no more than 4 or 5, he'd be back, either here or on some other little lonely mountain road, and he'd be doing it all over again. It was the job. It wasn't the action he'd wanted, but the pay was good, and every once in a while, something interesting came up. As the vehicle rolled off to the west to begin its journey back towards Van Nuys, the South African's phone rang, and he answered it.
"Verdoorn."
He listened a moment, cocked his head, then said,
"Kostas, that is indeed distressing news. I'm gonna have to go to the director with it, and he'll be bloody well displeased."
The Greek spoke a moment more, but Jaco interrupted him.
"I don't give a fuck who did it. I just know that..."
The bald-headed man in the polo shirt hesitated suddenly. This story about an entire way station shot up, 7 killed, a targeted assassination. Something about this triggered his brain. He changed his tune suddenly.
"Who did it?"
Seconds later, it was plain to the other two in the Mercedes that Jaco Verdoorn very clearly did give a fuck who did it.
"You're kidding me. How sure are they?"
A pause.
"Of course I bloody well know who that is."
He listened now as the Greek talked about a Bosnian police chief who he felt should be killed for allowing the hit to happen, and Jaco agreed, but he wasn't thinking about the police chief. No. He was thinking about the gray man, Cortland Gentry. Finally, he hung up, called a contact in the Serbian government in Banja Luka for confirmation, and then hung up from that call and looked down at his phone. He thought about calling the director immediately. The man did not like to be bothered during the night, but Jaco knew he'd have to get approval for the hit on the Bosnian cop. Still, as the wheels in the South African's mind turned, he realized he would need more information about the American assassin before going to his boss. And he knew where to get it. With a pounding heart that only came from the prospect of hunting the most dangerous prey in the world, the South African smiled now.
"What's up, boss?"
asked the driver.
Verdurin said, "Trying not to get my hopes up too high, Samuel, but we might have ourselves a spot of fun on the horizon."
The man in the back spoke with sarcasm.
"What? More exciting than this?"
Verdurin ignored him. The driver saw the look in his boss's eye.
"New target, sir."
Samuel knew there was only one thing that his boss considered fun. Verdurin brought the phone to his ear as he placed the call. To his driver, he said, still through a smile,
"New target."
7.
I dream about the women in the cellar. I can't make out any faces clearly, but I see eyes shining red. Desolate, fearful, despairing orbs that track me wherever I move. I am enveloped by the sights and sounds of their prison. I sense the inevitable bleakness of their futures, and more disheartening, I see that they sense that bleakness as well. And then, just before I wake up, I remember that this is all my motherfucking fault. Opening my eyes now, I realize that I am not in the Red Room, but I don't know where I am. I wake up in a different hotel or apartment or flophouse or bunk bed with staggering regularity, so I'm used to the sensation. My left hand hurts, and the muscles all over my body feel strained and knotted. Also, nothing out of the ordinary for me. I've seen action, that much is clear by my aches and pains. I'm on the floor of a closet with a gear bag under my head, which also tells me I'm operational. I always sleep in closets when I can for my own security, and I'm more comfortable here on the floor than alone in a comfortable bed. You get like this when people make killing you their life's work. I lie there, shake off the dream, and remember the reality that was last night. Bobbik, the women and girls, the dogs, the gunfire and shouting and running. And then I remember Liliana. Did she leave? I sit up quickly. When I lay down, she had already fallen asleep in the bed, so my eyes go there. I see only tousled bedsheets. Shit. But I scan to the right and find her in the little living room of the apartment, sitting at a table by the window, looking down at the street into the night. I lie back down, pleased to see that at least one of us is working. It all comes back quickly. I'm in the closet of a third-floor walk-up flat in Mostar, Bosnia, overlooking the main police station. I rented it this morning after feeding Liliana and myself and buying both of us new clothes. I also remember something about a fuzzy plan I had to help the women I left behind in the cellar, and that's the only reason I'm not 300 miles away by now in Zagreb, boarding a train to Prague for a flight back to America. That was plan A. But Alpha is shot, and to be honest, I'm having trouble remembering a time where I actually executed a plan A. I need to get back to the States, and I don't need to be over here, 15 miles from where I fucked up a farmload of gunmen last night, playing house with a sex-trafficked Moldovan woman in an attempt to rescue an unknown number of victims from an unknown number of perpetrators who are I don't even know where. Fuck. Plan Alpha is out the window, and so far Plan Bravo isn't looking too hot either. I think again about returning to the States. The Bobbik hit was a freelance assignment, but I also have a day job. Sort of. Contract work for the CIA. I used to be an actual employee, then they tried to kill me, and now we've patched some things up. They are still officially hunting me down, but the director of operation uses me as his own deniable asset, an off-book hitter in a blacker-than-black program called Poison Apple. So I have a little pull, and that keeps the American goons off my back. At least for now. Yeah, everything about my relationship with the agency is bonkers. They piss me off consistently, and I'm sure I'm personally responsible for a sizable portion of antacid sales in the pharmacies in and around Langley. But I do help them out from time to time. Not sure what they do for me, really. But I guess I'm doing my civic duty or something by killing the enemies of America. And that's important, isn't it? I could call my handler at the agency, tell her what I saw here, and maybe enlist the assistance of the best intelligence service on Earth. But I decide against it. She'd probably just tell me to get my ass back to work, and the agency would know in a heartbeat that I was the one who killed Bobbick. And I don't need that. I look over the little flat now. The girl just sits at the window in the low light, smoking cigarettes I bought her to help calm her, staring out to the street in silence. Even in the dim here, I can see the hard look in her eyes. But I figure it's just what she's been through these past few weeks. Then I ask myself, what the hell am I doing here? I should bail on all this. I should walk away before this goes deeper, because everything always seems to go deeper if I stick around long enough. Yeah, I should get out, get back to the United States, back to the agency. I can't save those girls I saw at the farm. They're in the wind by now, I'm sure of it. Soon, I sit up again, knowing all this thinking is a waste of time. Of course I'm going to see this through. I always do. And I always will, until the day I go lights out as a result of catching a supersonic hunk of copper-jacketed lead with my forehead. That day is coming. I'm as sure of this as I am that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. A minute later, I sit down next to Liliana with a couple of bottles of Velebitsko beer in my hand. How are you?
Fine,
she says, and she takes a beer, but she's not fine. She just gazes out the window down at the station. Anything so far? I ask.
No, nothing.
My camera sits on the table next to her, but I don't think she's even touched it. I look at my watch and see that it's 9 p.m. You need to take a break. I can watch, take pictures, show you when you wake up.
I don't sleep very much.
I imagine not, I think. It's quiet in the room for a moment, and then I ask, you were kidnapped in Tiraspol by this group?
By another group. They were locals, Moldovans. Then I was sold into the pipeline, moved from east to west, each time a different group. But I do not know who in charge.
When they took you, what were you doing? She doesn't look away from the front door of the police station across the street. She answers matter-of-factly.
I was working, girl.
She means a prostitute, and this surprises me. She doesn't look like a prostitute. How long have you been doing that?
I make cakes in bakery in small town, but I want to live big city. I want to be something. I go to Tiraspol when I 20, and no work, so.
She stops there, but I get it. I don't ask her again how long she's been a working girl. She looks 30 to me, but taking into account her impossibly tough life, I figure she's about 25. Shit. With what she's been through, she could be even younger. I don't know why I say the next words that come out of my mouth, but it's probably due to the crippling guilt that I'm feeling right now about my responsibility for the fate of those women in the Red Room. What happened to you? It isn't your fault. She waves a hand.
Other girls taken from nightclubs, from normal jobs, from other places. Other girls tricked into sex. I taken from brothel. I make sex for money. I am not victim.
Blowing out a sigh, I reply with, after what's happened to you, only a true victim would say she was no victim. But I see I'm not getting through to her. Talking isn't my strong suit. It's why I tend to shoot people in the face instead. But I try again. If you help me help those girls, you can do some good. She shakes her head.
You no help those girls. You hurt those girls when you came.
Yeah, I know. She looks me over.
Why you kill old man?
He was a Serbian general in the war. A bad one. War crimes. She rolls her eyes.
The war? You mean the war before I was born?
Yeah.
Nobody care about that war. You come and kill him for it, and now the girls suffer.
I nod. I get it. She adds,
girls are gone. taken away somewhere else.
After a moment of silence, she softens, sips her beer, and says,
soon, new girls taken from Moldova.
This shit happens every day around the world, doesn't it? I hadn't even been thinking about the larger picture of this, only the women and girls I saw who, by my actions, were condemned to more brutality. She shrugs.
I do not know the world. I know only Tiraspol, Belgrade, and here. But yes, every day some new girl has freedom taken away.
More to myself than to her, I say. The shit I've seen in this life. My voice trails off because the shit I've seen in this life is not really any of her business. But she surprises me with her response. She takes a long swig of the beer, and then she turns to face me again.
The shit you see, what it make you want to do?
I think about the question. It makes me want to kill people.
Yes, I want to kill people too.
She nods.
But that does not make everything better.
Maybe she's right. Maybe she's wrong. I see the shittiest parts of humanity, and it is a soul-sucking experience, but at least I have an outlet. I am an assassin, a killer of men. Someone like Liliana, a baker forced into prostitution by economic hardship, then kidnapped into slavery. What can she do but sit there and take the world as it comes to her like a monster reaching out from under her bed? Neither of us speaks for over a minute. Finally, I break the uncomfortable silence. When you get home to Moldova, I wouldn't go back to Tiraspol. She nods.
I go back to bakery. It is safe. No one steal baker for sex traffic.
She has the right idea, and I clink my beer bottle against hers. She starts to bring it back to her mouth while she keeps her eyes across the street. But she stops suddenly and points out the window.
There! That cop! Getting out of the car!
It's a white SUV with the Mostar police logo in blue on the side. A driver climbs out and steps up to the sidewalk, opening the back door of the vehicle when he does so. You know him from the farm?
Yes. He not in charge, but he always with man in charge.
The passenger side opens now, and almost as soon as the man steps out, Liliana recoils.
He man in charge.
A cop in his 40s wearing a smart uniform takes off his cap, rubs his hand over his short gray stubble, and then replaces it. That asshole right there?
Da.
You know his name?
I hear them call him Nico. That is all.
She begins to cry suddenly, her hardened look evaporating in an instant. Three men in total climb out of the vehicle, and another two emerge from a second identical SUV. They all walk together up the steps to the front door of the police station. I take a few pictures, focusing on the one called Nico, then help Liliana out of her chair and lead her back over to the bed by her arm. She is weeping still, and I sit her down. You did great. You just made a difference. Get some rest. Tomorrow morning I'll take you to the train station and tell you how to get home.
What about Nico?
I smile a little in the dim light. I'll be back for Nico. She nods slowly. I start to stand to return to the window, but she holds me by the wrist.
You are good man.
I'm not, but I say, thanks. She pulls me closer, tries to lead me down onto the bed on top of her. I attempt to break away without making a big deal out of it, but her grip is surprisingly strong. I say, you aren't thinking straight, Liliana. You need to sleep. There are fresh tears in her eyes now.
I know what you need. I give you what you need.
She's wrong. I don't need that. Not like this. No, you aren't thinking straight, I repeat. I stop her advances as gently as I can, but gentle isn't exactly my strong suit. Within seconds, I have her arms pinned over her head, and only then does she stop trying to pull me down. She nods without emotion now.
This you like? You like rough?
Shit. No, I'm sorry, I say. But I can't. I let go of her arms, but she doesn't move them. She sniffs and looks at me quizzically. She doesn't seem offended, just surprised.
Assassin who is gay, or assassin with girlfriend?
I marvel at the absurdity of this moment. There's a girl. Another dispassionate nod from the Romanian.
British girl?
The comment confuses me, but then I remember that I'm Prince Harry. Surprising myself, I don't lie when I answer her. No, a Russian girl. I get yet another look from her like she thinks I'm an idiot. With all the certainty in the world, she replies,
Russian girl, she'd take your money.
Not this one. Then,
Russian girl drink too much.
To this I shrug. You may be right about that. She looks at me, then again says,
You are good man.
A good man. She's got me all wrong. For the third time I say, You aren't thinking straight, Liliana. Get some rest. 8. It was an especially beautiful summer morning in the Hollywood Hills. Three kids, a 10-year-old boy, and girls of 12 and 16, lounged around the infinity pool behind an Italian Renaissance revival mansion. A woman in her 40s looked gorgeous while sipping her coffee at a table on the expansive back patio, and landscapers and gardeners toiled around the steeply graded 2-acre property. The skyline of LA was striking in the distance. The smoggy haze that usually blanketed the city was less pronounced than usual. And all this filled 54-year-old Kenneth Cage with a sense of peace. His palatial home had been built in the 1940s for a Hollywood mogul, and an impressive list of actors and musicians had resided there over the years. Cage himself was attached to the world of entertainment via one of his businesses, but he had more money than any five of the movie stars or rock stars who'd ever lived at this Hollywood address. And this home was but one of six he kept here in the United States. There was Steamboat Springs and Boston and New York and Jackson Hole and Lake Tahoe, and he had his eyes on a 400-acre winery in Sonoma County. All this wealth and property came with a cost, of course. Even now as he sat at his kitchen island, looking out the open patio door and enjoying his family while they enjoyed the fruit of his labors, in the distance he also counted three men patrolling the well-manicured grounds. There were three more somewhere around here he couldn't see, and the house was lined with cameras, all fed into a control center with yet another security officer monitoring them. The leader of Ken Cage's security detail was an ex-Navy SEAL and LAPD SWAT officer named Sean Hall. And while the other men rotated in three shifts throughout the day, Hall lived in a detached 2,000-square-foot pool house just off the patio, and he went everywhere his boss went from the hours of 9 a.m. until Cage was tucked into bed at night. Right now, Sean was still in his pool house, because Cage had a strict rule, no work before 9. That meant no bodyguards inside the mansion, no phone calls or emails, no spreadsheets or PowerPoints or business-related visitors. Cage traveled on business regularly, but he was a family man, and when he was home, he carved out time for Heather and the kids. Cage always told others that he regarded the security precautions as one of the ancillary and necessary costs of success, but the truth was, he liked the feeling of significance it conveyed when he walked as the nucleus of a group of beefy ex-cops and military men. Heather didn't like the intrusion into her life brought on by the bodyguards, but Ken truly didn't mind because it fed his massive ego. He finished his breakfast on the marble kitchen counter, chatted briefly with his son about the Dodgers' win over the Twins the night before, and looked over some art made by his 12-year-old daughter, pronouncing the watercolor to be magnificent. Soon his three kids were swimming and splashing in the big infinity pool overlooking the city skyline. Heather would join them as soon as she changed into her bathing suit, but now she sat on the sofa with her husband in the living room, enjoying her coffee and his companionship before he retired into his home office for the workday. They were in the middle of a discussion about colleges for their daughter. Cage had gone to Princeton and then Wharton, while Heather had graduated from Harvard, but Charlotte wanted to go to UCLA and get a degree in fine arts.
Heather was pushing for Ken to use his clout to try to get her into Harvard, and just as Ken tried to shift the conversation back to Princeton, his mobile rang and he glanced down at it, saw the number, and furrowed his brow.
"What's wrong?"
asked Heather.
"It's 8:50 and this is work. On my cell."
He rolled his eyes.
"I don't punch in till 9 when I'm home. Everybody knows this is my family time."
She smiled back at him.
"You've been a good boy lately. I'll let you off the hook today."
Ken chuckled.
"Nope. I'll get rid of him and go hang with the kids while you get your suit on."
Despite the work interruption, Cage answered the phone with a little smile on his face. He couldn't help it. Life was good. With a light and airy voice, he said,
"Hey there, I'll call you back in about 15.
Ken Cage stopped talking. As he listened, his smile faded, and he stood. To Heather, he said, "Gotta take this. Sorry, babe." He turned and headed for his study. When he closed himself in, he walked over to his antique walnut partner's desk, picked up a remote, and pressed a button. Instantly, his office stereo system, a $500,000 Bacchus and Mular BM-100, began projecting the lifelike, warm, rich sounds of a thunderstorm throughout the room. He sat down and spoke in a low and gruff voice, utterly different than the one he had been using with his family.
"We're going encrypted."
"Encrypted," came the confirmation from the man on the other end of the line, speaking with a heavy South African accent.
Now Cage tapped some unmarked buttons at the bottom of his phone system. The sound over the line changed a little, as did the tonal qualities of the men's voices, but the two could hear each other without difficulty. Cage opened with,
"Fuck Yakko, you know the rules, no calls till 9.
"Something's happened."
"I told you to send the two whores back home and then get over to Berlin. You need me to hold your hand for that?"
If Yakko Verdoorn felt chastened, he didn't show it in his voice.
"Sorry, sir, but this isn't about the two items you asked me to deal with. A new situation warrants your attention."
"What situation?"
"Bosnia, sir."
"You know what? Stop. I don't have time for any drama right now. I've got to prepare for the trip next week to..."
"A hitman killed 7, including the man running the Mostar way station, a former Serb general named Bubik."
Kenneth Cage, the director of the consortium, froze in place at his desk for a moment. Then he said,
"Well, that's pretty dramatic. Who hired the hitman?"
"The Serbs think a Croatian concern was gunning for Bubik due to his activities in the 90s, and when they found out where he was living, they outsourced the hit so they didn't start anything directly with either Serbia or Bosnia and Herzegovina."
Cage knew the name Ratko Bubik, but he'd know nothing about Bubik working for him. He'd not even known Mostar was a way station. He never concerned himself with the minutiae of his operation, considering himself above that level of work. He delegated power both to optimize efficiency and to keep his hands clean. Cage wasn't ready to involve himself in these dirty affairs across the globe directly.
"I can't believe I'm talking to you about this shit. You need to handle stuff like this before it makes its way up to me."
"Frankly, sir, we've never encountered anything like this."
With a sigh, the man in Hollywood said,
"The regional director over there in Croatia, he's the Greek guy, right?"
"Kostas Kostopoulos, yes. I've been in contact with him.
Tell him he's got carte blanche to find this asshole and terminate him. That's the word you guys use for this sort of shit, isn't it?"
It's one way of putting it, I suppose. But I'm not sure Kostas's people are the right men for the job."
"Why not?"
"They have limited range and no influence anywhere other than in the Balkans. This might be something I need to handle alone. I can find him, and I can eliminate him."
Cage looked down at his phone.
"You? You've got better things to do running my day-to-day operations than going on a personal safari for some hitman."
"Respectfully, I think he could pose a threat to our interests, and I should also take steps to..."
"Come on, Yakko," Cage said. "You aren't a manhunter anymore. You're helping me run a $10 billion a year business."
A pause from the other end, and then the South African responded with obvious disappointment.
"Yes, sir. I'll tell the Greek to look for the assassin."
Cage hung up, then looked at the grandfather clock on the wall.
It was after 9 now, so he opened up an email to check this month's numbers in Denmark. As the director of the consortium, he was responsible for keeping his eyes on the bottom line. But his attention didn't stay on work for long. This new situation in Bosnia, the removal of the two girls, a trip he had planned to Italy in just a few days, and the arrival of his next shipment of merchandise, including two new girls he'd taken a particular interest in. There was a lot for Ken Cage to think about these days, a lot of balls in the air. He began poring through the Danish numbers, telling himself he'd spend the full day in his home office. Police Captain Niko Vukovic left his station at 10 p.m., climbing into his SUV with his driver and his chief protection agent, both well-trained officers, with a chase vehicle rolling behind with two more cops. They drove north towards Vukovic's residence to the south of the urban center of Mostar, just on the east side of the small but swift near Evtva River. A gray Mercedes panel truck followed the two SUVs the entire way, but traffic was dense enough tonight, and none of the five cops picked up on the tail. The two police vehicles pulled into a small, quiet square 3 blocks from the river and stopped in front of an old gray building close to the street. The two bodyguards, who weren't also drivers, climbed out with the captain, then walked him into his residence. A few minutes later, the pair of guards exited the building, leaving Niko Vukovic alone inside. Once the protectee was safely ensconced in his residence for the evening, the two SUVs rolled out of the square. None of the four cops providing security for their chief noticed the gray van rolling slowly up a road on the far side of the square, finally coming to a standstill 10 meters before the intersection. Two individuals sat in the van now, but there were three in total in this team of Hungarian hitmen. The third, the unit leader, was busy back at the hotel, preparing their escape route, poring over maps, circling areas of major congestion. The Hungarians were all active duty members of their own country's national police force, but they also worked a side job as enforcers for the Pitovci, an organized crime entity based in Bratislava, Slovakia. Normally, their duties for the Pitovci kept them in and around Budapest, where they lived and worked, just over the border from the Slovakian capital. But today, they had been sent much farther abroad, all the way here in southern Bosnia. The men had driven themselves down and checked into a local hotel with forged passports, but they had no plans to stay in town long, a night to reconnoiter and a night to act, and then they'd race back north. These men had killed before, and they were confident they had it down. The passenger in the van made a call on his mobile, waited a moment, then said,
"He's home. His security has left for the night. No, they didn't even stay with him. I'll text you the address. 15 minutes from the hotel. Karoli and I can do it right now if you want." "No," came the reply. "We have a plan. We are sticking to it. Tomorrow night, all three of us."
"Okay, boss. You want us to stay here?"
"For another hour. Just make sure he doesn't have any visitors."
"Mergentin,
I understand." The Hungarian in the passenger seat ended the call, then looked to the driver.
"Wouldn't be hard. Small town Bosnian police chief. What's the big deal?"
"You know, Zenti, if he makes a plan, you're not going to change it."
"Yeah,"
the other man said.
"He does like to be the boss, doesn't he?"
The road where the van sat had a good view to the building across the tiny square, but from the Hungarian's vantage point, they were unable to see a darkened alcove in front of a small mosque to the right of the intersection in front of them. There, a lone woman stood in a black raincoat, and she kept her eyes on the same building as the men on her left, who she was also unable to see. Talissa Korbu was 29 years old, thin, with small elvish facial features and short dyed red hair, mostly hidden by the hood of her jacket. She was a foreigner here in Bosnia and, also like the men sitting 30 meters to her left in the van, she was associated with law enforcement. This was Talissa's second day in Mostar. On the first, she'd staked out the police station for 10 hours before seeing what she wanted to see, and then she had followed Niko Vukovic home.
She'd come back this morning, saw him head into work around 10 a.m., and then tried breaking into the man's apartment building in broad daylight. But Vukovic had good locks and a better security system, and his building had several other units nearby. Moreover, he lived next door to a private daycare that created a lot of come-and-go activity on the sidewalk out front during the daytime hours. So she had abandoned this plan, and instead, she spent the day here in the tiny little park at the center of the square, a kilometer north of the old bridge, waiting for Vukovic to come home. Now she waited for his light to switch off. Minutes later, it did. And then Talisa Korbu wrote the time down and began walking away.
Tomorrow, she told herself.
Tomorrow she'd get what she came for. It was a good line for her to repeat through her head. But the truth was, she had little real confidence in her plan. Unlike the Hungarians, Korbu was not here on the job for anyone. No. This was personal as things got. She was in a foreign country planning on extracting information from a city police chief, and she had no training whatsoever to do so. But she also had no choice. She made her way back to her hotel a few minutes later, climbed the stairs to her room, all the while trying to come up with a better plan than the one she had now. Because she worried that the one she had now would get her killed long before she found what she was looking for. 9. Liliana and I get up at 5 a.m. and drive to Sarajevo, arriving at the main train station at 8, right in the middle of the morning flow of commuters. Since she doesn't have a passport, I spend most of the drive from Mostar talking her through the tradecraft I employ to avoid immigration officials on trains. And as soon as we arrive, I book her a long, circuitous trip that will take her north into Croatia, then northeast into Hungary, then south into Romania, then finally east to Moldova. With a little luck and the info I give her, she'll make it home fine. And I also hand her 5,000 euros in case she needs to drop some bribes along the way to ensure all goes smoothly, as well as help her get started when she makes it back home. This route will keep her out of Serbia, and I make her promise to get off at the train in Moldova before she gets to Tiraspol, where she can take a local bus to her little town. She'll be fine, I tell myself, at least in the short term. Long term, I don't know what this experience has done to her, but I can take a guess. I feel bad for Liliana, because even if this is over for her, it's not over for her. The public address system announces the boarding of the train to Zagreb, and Liliana looks up at me without speaking. Take care of yourself, is all I can manage. She hesitates, and I realize she's trying to think of something to say as well. I figure she could just say thanks, but I've got her all wrong.
The other girls, Harry, they're not like me. They don't deserve what happened to them.
Jesus. This woman is so psychologically damaged, I don't know if she'll ever recover. It's the most depressing thing I've seen in the past day. Not the violence, the murder, the kidnapping, the rape. It's the fucking with people's brains that is the end result of shit like this. Like someone once fucked with mine. This world, I swear to God, if there weren't just a few good people left in it, I'd burn it down to the ground with me inside. I wish I had a way to make her understand that what happened to her isn't her fault. But I'm not that guy. All I say is, go home. Be safe. Find out what makes you happy and then do it. Everybody's got to do something that makes them happy. I give her a smile, or my version of one. It's stressed, tired, forced. But it's all I've got at a moment like this. She nods and boards the train. I wonder about her, whether she'll go back to her village or whether she'll go back to Tiraspol to start turning tricks again. I have no idea. I'm a gunfighter, full stop. So much of the other stuff that happens around me is over my head. I tell myself this so I don't think about it too much, but it doesn't really work. I think about it all the time. A minute later, I'm in my Jeep heading back to Mostar, ready to beat the holy fuck out of some piece of shit dirty cop because, just as I told Liliana,
Everybody's got to do something that makes them happy. Shortly before 10 p.m., the three Hungarian police officers working for the Slovakian mob stood in the shadows of a side street just 25 meters from the foyer to Vukovic's old building, smoking cigarettes and doing their best to control the adrenaline that had been rising in their bodies all day as the moment their target arrived home from work approached. Their plan was straightforward, but it had worked for them in the past in similar situations. When his vehicles pulled up out front, they'd start walking along in that direction, just three men out for an evening stroll. And then, when Vukovic and his two guards were close to them on the sidewalk, the three Hungarians would pull pistols. Two would shoot the three on foot, while the third man would empty his handgun into the driver's side windshields of the two SUVs on the curb. Three men attacking five didn't sound like great odds, but the Hungarians knew they would have complete surprise on their side, and they were confident killers. The leader of the group looked down at his phone.
Should be leaving the station about now, probably another 10 minutes till he's here.
Karoli replied,
We're ready.
And Florian said,
Quick and dirty, like last year in Maribor.
Zente, the leader, nodded.
Just like Maribor.
While the Hungarians had chosen a closer position than the night before, Talisa Korbu stood in the same darkened alcove she'd hidden in the previous evening. And also the same as the night before, she was unable to see the Hungarians because her sightline into their side street was obstructed by a corner building. Unaware she wasn't the only person here right now with aims on the Mostar chief of police, Korbu had a plan of her own. She would wait for the police chief to be dropped off, and then, once the man was alone in his flat, Korbu would walk across the square and knock on his door. Using authentic credentials in her pocket, but hoping to flash them so fast the cop didn't catch her name, Korbu would make her way inside and then pull out the little stainless steel pistol she'd bought on the street in Belgrade a few days earlier. She'd demand answers from Vukovic, threaten him by waving both her gun and her credos, and just stay there and keep it up until she got what she wanted. That Korbu had never shot anyone, had never roughed anyone up for information, had never even been trained with handguns was not lost on her. But with each passing day since she left her home, her limits had been challenged, broken, and thrown out the window. She stood there in the alcove, checking the time on her phone and talking to herself over and over in a frantic whisper.
You can do this. You can do this.
I shift my eyes left and right as my brain tries to take in and process the scene in front of me. In the distance, I see three men in the dark next to a gray van in an alley near the home of my target. And they definitely do not look like part of his security team. They've got the bearing of police officers, but they are plain clothed. And from their furtive looks to Vukovic's building and their nervous pacing around the alley, I think they've got some sort of mayhem in mind. These guys are waiting for the chief of police of Mostar, and they're not going to get his autograph. My guess is they're here to kill him, and I can't let them do that. Not yet, anyway. But the three men in the alley are just one part of the equation. Ahead and to my left, on the opposite side of the quiet little square, I see a lone man covered in a hooded raincoat doing his best to stay invisible next to a darkened mosque. A couple of vehicles have rolled through in the past 5 minutes, and both times I saw the figure in the edges of their headlights, and both times the man shuffled and bounced from one foot to the other with nervous tension. Focusing on the black alcove helps me see him a little better now, even without the headlights, but I can't make out a face. This guy is a lookout for the three in the alley? It's the only thing that makes sense to me, but I can't be certain. Otherwise, he's some sort of solo act, just like me, because I don't see anyone else around. I'm inside a real estate office opposite the alleyway where the three men are standing by the van, maybe 40 meters away. I broke into this business half an hour ago, wanting a secure place to watch the square, just to get a feel for the rhythm of the scene. A few passing vehicles, one or two people walking dogs on cobblestone streets on a warm night, lights on in many of the windows of apartment buildings. But a manageable location for my plan. Except for the three in the alley. And the other guy. I know I have to remove the three closest to the building from my picture before Vukovic arrives, which, if he leaves work at the same time every night, could be in the next 10 minutes. Steeling myself for what's to come, I push the thoughts of the guy by the mosque out of my mind for the short term, put my hand on the latch of the door to the real estate agency, and take one deep breath. Then I step out onto the sidewalk and begin walking in the direction of the alley. I stroll past my target's building on my right and continue forward, closing on the three men smoking in the dim light. I don't look up at them. I just advance as if I'm planning on walking by. I pass the building that shields me from the other man in the square, the bozo I take for the lookout for the muscle team. And then, when I'm just 10 feet from the three men, I stop and turn their way. All three are looking at me. They drop their smokes onto the sidewalk. "Hi, gents. Any chance you guys speak English?" The man in the middle is the leader. This is clear in an instant.
"What do you want?"
"I was just wondering what's going on."
"What?
Come on. Three big dudes standing around a dark alleyway next to a rape van. What's the plan here, fellas?"
"Keep walking,"
says another one of the three, and now I recognize the accent. These guys aren't local, they're Hungarian. Scanning their clothing and their shoes as I speak, I say, "I think you guys need to call it a night. Go get a beer." They look at one another in confusion now, and my eyes burrow into the folds of their jackets, their front pockets, the cuffs on their pants. I don't see any weapons printing there, but it's dark and these guys seem like pros, so just because I don't know yet where they're hiding their guns doesn't mean they aren't hiding guns. The man in the middle takes a step closer, and the others do the same.
"Who are you? You are not police. You are not from here. Why do you care where we stand?"
I don't answer immediately. I just stare the man down with a slight smile on my face. My actions are bizarre, true, but I have a plan. Right now, I'm just talking to them, but I'm doing it in a way that ratchets up the heat slowly, to the point where they will eventually realize that I am, in fact, a danger, and not just some oddball American tourist. It's all to elicit the reaction I'm looking for out of them. But so far, I'm not getting what I need. Time to turn the ratchet some more. Still looking the men over, I lower my voice from its light and airy tone, giving it some heft. I say,
"I'm the guy who's going to stop you from doing your jobs tonight."
This plainly is a threat, and I begin to get what I seek from the Hungarians. In my business, we call them grooming cues, a subconscious touching of the area where a weapon is hidden when an armed person feels a threat and is readying himself to draw. They all do it within seconds of one another. The big man on my left crosses his hands in front of his waist and surreptitiously pats just above and to the right of his crotch. This tells me he's got a pistol in an appendix holster to the right of his belt buckle. The man in the center unzips his coat and then, as he takes his hand away, brushes across the right side of his chest under his arm. From this, I determine he's also carrying a handgun, but in a shoulder holster. And the one on my right may have multiple weapons, but his left hand slips nonchalantly into his pants pocket, and I can see he's taken hold of something there. It's printing on the fabric now, and it looks like it could be a closed switchblade. While this is happening, the leader of the group asks me again who I am and what I want with them. I can tell he is stalling for time, trying to figure out if I'm with Vukovic, if I'm some idiotic American mugger, or if I'm something else. "You got this, gentry," I tell myself, psyching myself up for the violence I know is mere seconds away. But while I do this, I keep talking. "So, if you guys just want to get back in that van and head home to Budapest, it would probably be for the best, because nothing good is going to come from..." The man on my right takes a nonchalant step forward, but I read his intent. He's closing the space, getting into striking distance, and I know this means his knife is coming out. I could go for my gun, but I sure as shit am not going to fire right outside the home of the man I'm planning on snatching in a couple of minutes. It would turn the dark square into a mob scene of onlookers before Vukovic even arrives. Instead, I keep talking, angling my body towards Knife Man so I can get a foot up in his face fast when he goes for it. He goes for it. Just as I shift weight, he turns into a flurry of movement, lunging forward while pulling a switchblade. It opens with a click that echoes in the alleyway, but before he can stab me, I send one of my size 10.5 leather Merrell boots up into his nose, and I hear the bone snap as his head pitches back hard enough to give him whiplash. With my right leg still coming down from the kick, I throw myself forward to the man in the middle, who is now drawing from his shoulder under his jacket. I pin his hand there against his weapon before he can pull it, and then, as soon as my right leg lands, I launch my left foot out towards the guy on my left, short-circuiting his appendix draw by kicking his hand at his belt, breaking one of his fingers as his pistol clatters into the alleyway. I headbutt the man in the center now, striking my forehead against the top of his nose while still controlling his gun hand against his body. My ears ring and pain fires from my head into my spine, but he falls back towards the wall and slides to the pavement, and I can tell by the blood that his nose is broken as well. No gunfire so far, which is good news, but this hasn't exactly gone down quietly. All three of them made some sort of loud noise when I struck them, and the inevitable echo through the alley into the square makes me certain that the lookout in the alcove 50 meters away is aware his associates are in some sort of a melee. I pull the gun out of the center man's shoulder holster as he falls onto the cobblestones, conscious but temporarily out of the fight because of his broken nose. The guy on the right also has a busted snot box, but he pulls himself up by the back bumper of the gray van. From the looks of him, I've got 3 seconds or so before he becomes dangerous again, so I turn back to the man on the far left. Instantly, I see that this dude still has a lot of fight left in him. He's lost his pistol, but he draws a hooked knife from a belt sheath at the small of his back under his jacket, and he slashes wildly with his uninjured hand as he lunges my way. I duck the blade, shift to his right, and use the pistol I just lifted from the leader of the group to bash him in the left temple as hard as I can. His arms cartwheel, he drops the knife, and he hits the back of the van face first. I thank the Lord the van doesn't have a burglar alarm, because his impact shakes the vehicle on its shocks. The Hungarian who had been on my right has pulled himself halfway back up to his feet, but by doing so, he's put his head in a perfect position for me to dropkick him in the chin. He probably already has whiplash, but this time, I just about decapitate him. He falls down on his back, unconscious, like the man next to him. I point the leader's gun in the leader's face as I kneel and speak softly but quickly, knowing Vukovic should be pulling up right now. So there is no more time to hang out in this alley in plain view of the entrance to his building behind me. Call your friend. Where's your radio? I fish around in his jacket, but don't find anything. You're using your mobile phones for comms? The man's nose bleeds freely into his open mouth as he says, What friend? The lookout over by the mosque. The other? The headlights of 2 vehicles flash in the square behind me, reflecting off the glass of Vukovic's building, and I know that in seconds, the occupants of both vehicles will see me. I'm sure it's the police chief and his security entourage, so I have to get out of their line of sight somehow. I hoist back my right hand and punch the leader in the jaw, knocking him out cold, same as his colleagues. Hurriedly, I drag him behind the van, grab the second man by the arm, and pull him most of the way behind cover. And then, just as a pair of Mostar police vehicles turn onto the street that gives them a clear view straight ahead into my alley, I grab the third man, heave him up off the ground, shuffle 1 step back, and then fall with him onto the other 2, mostly out of view behind the van. But not totally out of view. My feet are sticking out from behind the van, as are those of the dude I've got in a bear hug. Looking down, I see that the legs of the 2 men under me are protruding as well. We're a big pile of bodies, and we'd be obvious to anyone looking right at us. But we're 25 yards away, in a relatively dark alleyway, and I'm hoping like hell everybody in the 2 vehicles rolling to a stop now has their attention elsewhere. Otherwise, I have a shit ton of explaining to do. To my right, the leader of the group moans softly and starts moving. I slam an elbow into his face, knocking the back of his head into the cobblestones, and the noise and movement stop. Looking down between my legs, I see 3 men get out of the 2 vehicles. Vukovic is in the group, and they all head towards his building. Nobody looks my way, which is good. But when the 3 go inside, the 2 vehicles roll off, which is bad. Chief Vukovic has company tonight. A pair of bodyguards. It's too late to snatch him on the street. And breaching his house without getting into a gunfight in the center of town isn't looking too likely either. But just as I sit up and start trying to come up with a plan C, the man in my arms wakes up. He looks around slowly. Clearly, he's in no position to put up a fight. I lean into his ear. Take your pals and go home. Heal up. If you're ready in 2 weeks, come back for Vukovic. Kill him. But I need him alive right now. I don't know if Niko Vukovic will be here in 2 weeks. He might be in jail, he might be in hiding, and he might be dead. But the Hungarians are my backup if I fail. I climb to my feet, pushing the dazed man off me. And then, just as I stand upright, I see the man in the black raincoat from the outcove step out onto the sidewalk, walking towards the police chief's house. He starts to turn in my direction, and I freeze again, but this time it doesn't work. The man's eyes lock on mine. And now I see that this is not a man. A young woman stares at me, mouth agape. She stops walking and stands there in the middle of the street. The lookout is a woman. Why not? Assuming she has put together the fact that I just beat the shit out of her 3 cohorts, I expect her to draw on me if she's carrying a weapon. I've got my Glock in my waistband, and I begin to reach for it. But the lookout, standing 20 yards away, does something I don't expect. She turns to her left and runs, disappearing around the corner of a building in an instant. I take off as well, giving chase. 10. I turn and search the darkened little square for the lady in the black raincoat. I don't see her. But I do see the elongating shadow of a figure running through one of the side streets to the east. I leap onto and then over a bench, and I race around little trees, up a steeply angled cobblestone street. I cross a footbridge over the Neretva, passing where I saw the shadow, which I can no longer find, although I do catch a quick flash of movement ahead and on the left. A car door shuts quickly. The driver fires the engine of the 2-door hatchback. An instant later, headlights engulf me as the vehicle lurches in my direction. I am not 100% sure this is the black raincoat lady, but I like the odds. I definitely don't want to fire my pistol and alert the entire neighborhood, but I draw it anyway, hoping the lethal weapon in my hand will force the driver to stop the lethal weapon barreling down on me before it runs me over. Like magic, the Glock 19 does the trick. The car skids to a halt feet away, with me standing in its path, my gun leveled at the driver's head through the windshield. I move around to the passenger's side and get in, still keeping the barrel trained on the driver. Only now do I see that this is, in fact, the woman in the black raincoat. Her hair is covered by her hood, but wisps of dyed red hair poke out. Her skin is alabaster white, her eyes wide, heavily bloodshot, and with gray half-moons under them. And they are locked on the weapon pointed at her. You armed? I ask it in English because I don't speak Hungarian.
What?
Gun. Do you have a gun? I can see in her eyes that she does. After a moment, she gives a little nod and speaks through the heavy breath that came from her run through the square and across the bridge.
It's in my pocket.
She has an accent, but it's faint. Her English is flawless. I wait a few seconds, then say, if you tell me which pocket, then I won't have to run my hands all over you. We just met, after all. She looks scared shitless, and in a voice that confirms to me she is, in fact, scared shitless, she says,
my jacket, on the right.
I reach in and pull out a stainless semi-auto that looks and feels like a piece of junk. I stick it in my back pocket, then say, anything else? She shakes her head emphatically, and I believe her. She's so tense I worry she might spontaneously combust, and I quickly realize that she doesn't have much of a background in this sort of thing. Certainly not the way her 3 buddies obviously did. Thinking for a moment, I decide I might be able to get some info off her about Niko Vukovic. The Hungarians probably know more about the man and his movements than I do, after all. Stay calm, I say. Just drive. The young woman stares at me, still breathing heavily from her run. Finally, she asks,
drive where?
Let's find some place quiet to go talk.
I do not wish to go with you.
I do not give a shit. Waving the pistol again, I say, drive. She doesn't say one word while she motors her way out of the hilly town, up a dark, steep road. Nor do I, as my own heart rate is still up after the alley fight and the mad sprint. I need to focus on breathing, but through her silence, I can feel the terror emanating from her. I do nothing to calm her. Her fear is a tool I can employ to earn her compliance, and I won't give that up cheaply. Nearly 10 minutes later, I direct her to park in a quiet hillside overlook, mostly out of sight of the road and with no other vehicles around. She does as ordered, and then, with the lights of Mostar down below us, I take the keys out of the ignition and put them in my pocket. We are enshrouded in near darkness, but I can see her trembling hands well enough to know immediately if she reaches for a weapon, and my pistol is on my knee and ready for her. I say, "Your friends will all live, but they're going to need a doctor. I want them out of town tonight."
My friends?
She adopts a look of surprise and confusion. She puts on a good act, I'll give her that. "Or," I continue, "you could just leave them and run home on your own. Looked like that was what you were doing. It's your call."
I don't have any friends here. I just arrived in Bosnia 2 days ago. I live in the Netherlands."
"Wait, you aren't Hungarian?"
"Who said I was Hungarian? I'm Romanian."
"Now I'm confused, but I try not to let it show. You're not with the three guys watching Vukovic's house?" Now I see her first obvious lie.
"Who is Vukovic?"
Bullshit. Her mannerisms are all wrong for someone making a truthful statement. Whereas before her terrified eyes were locked to mine, now she glances down to the left and she brings one arm across her body, holding onto the steering wheel with it. These are tells I learned in my first day studying body language back at the CIA's Autonomous Asset Development Program in Harvey Point, North Carolina, and they are so obvious to me now, I can often pick up on deception without making any effort to do so. I say, "You were watching Vukovic's place too. I don't need you lying to me right now, and you don't need me angry with you." The woman looks out the windshield and nods. She looks exhausted.
"Yes, I was watching the home of Chief Vukovic. I did not know the others were doing this also."
"You didn't see the three big Hungarians?"
"No, I saw you. Then I heard fighting in the alleyway. I didn't know what was going on. When I saw you, I got scared and ran."
"You got scared?" "I get scared all the time, but I don't run into many people in the field who would admit this." She nods. She's still scared. Her eyes show only mistrust and apprehension, all directed towards me. She says,
"You are a gangster? You are part of the pipeline?"
Slowly I cock my head. I reach with my non-gun hand into her purse in the back seat, and I pull out a wallet. Flipping it open, I don't see a Romanian driver's license at first. Instead, I see an official-looking identity badge, and in my world, that's never good news. Talisa Corbu, Junior Criminal Analyst, Economic Crime Division, European Union Agency for Law Enforcement Cooperation. Europol. Terrific. The last time I checked, Europol had published international warrants for me on about 10 different charges, from Dublin to Tallinn, from Kyiv to Stockholm. Interpol, the World Police Organization, has a dozen more, from Hong Kong to Mexico City and from Ho Chi Minh City to D.C. I've got a healthy fear of cops, because in their eyes, I'm as bad a man as exists in this world. But even though this woman works for an agency that would like to see me thrown into a windowless cell somewhere, she clearly doesn't know who I am, and she's clearly not here for me. I say, "Europol coordinates with and supports law enforcement around the EU. Why would you be here, all by yourself, watching the home of a municipal police chief?" She looks at me with even more suspicion now, but I guess I'd be suspicious too, if some jackwad beat up three dudes, jumped in my car, stuck a gun in my face, and then took me to a darkened roadside turnoff.
"Is it any of your business?"
"I've got the gun, so my business is whatever I want to make it." She belts out a nervy laugh.
You are a gangster.
I'm not a gangster. Gangsters work for gangs. I don't. I'm self-employed. She makes no reply, but I gather she doesn't believe me. Her terror continues, and it's absolutely palpable. Even in the poor light, she appears almost ill to me. Now I want to calm her down a little, because she's no good to me while she's this amped up. And I don't need her tossing her cookies in my lap. I say, relax, Miss Corbu. It's possible you and I aren't enemies. I'm after Vukovic, too.
Why?
She asks with genuine surprise. You first.
I am here looking for someone.
Who?
I don't have to tell you.
I shake my head in disbelief. You really have no idea how this whole being held at gunpoint thing works, do you? I'm pretty sure that, in fact, you do have to tell me. She doesn't speak for 15 seconds, and then she starts to cry. I don't love making women cry, but I don't let off the pressure because I don't know what the hell is going on here. I shout now, who? And then, to my surprise, the meek little mouse shouts back at me,
my sister! I'm looking for my sister!
I didn't see that coming. Your sister? Talissa Corbu nods, tears dripping into her lap. She looks like a child again as she speaks through sobs.
Roxana, she disappeared 9 days ago. Her flatmate said she went to a nightclub in Bucharest, where she lives, and then she never came home. I flew in the next day. Local police were no help, even to me, a Europol analyst. They said she probably ran off to Germany or Italy or France, like all stupid girls. But Roxana would never do that. I did everything I could to find her. But then the police tried to stop me. I reached out to my office for assistance, but they just told me I needed to deal with family issues on my free time. I had to take a leave of absence to continue looking for her. Alone.
That's harsh, I say.
Then my mother received a phone call that she was later able to trace to Belgrade. She said the man had a Serbian accent, and this Serb said he found my mother's number in Roxana's phone. He wanted her to know he'd personally killed her daughter for meddling in the affairs of the Serbian mob.
I blow out a sigh. She's not looking for her sister. Whether she can admit it to herself or not, she's looking for her sister's body. She keeps talking, wiping her eyes with her sleeve.
The man on the phone said he shot her in Belgrade and then threw her into the river. Her body hasn't been recovered.
She looks at me, and her sad and exhausted eyes fill with hope for an instant.
Maybe she isn't dead.
It's not my place to force her to face the facts. Instead, I say, What does your sister do for a living?
She is a student at the University of Bucharest.
That's all?
Well, she is an actress, too.
With an incredulous look, I repeat her words. An actress?
Yes, some TV commercials, some plays. Nothing that paid the bills.
But why was she in Belgrade? And why would she be involved with the Serbian mob? The young woman looks down at her hands.
I have no idea.
She knows. Or at least she knows more than she's letting on. But I let it go for now. So what did you do?
I drove to Belgrade. I had this crazy idea I could get local authorities to help me because of my position. But Europol has no jurisdiction in Serbia. The cops there were okay at first. They searched the banks of the Danube River, said they'd make inquiries into the underworld. But after I kept coming back, kept pressing, they threatened to have me deported. In the end, I used resources at Europol to trace the call my mother received. The caller was using software to prevent a trace, but I had a friend in the technical division find the origin of the number. It was the phone of the wife of a man who has been on a European criminal organization watch list. He is a member of the Bronjevo Partisans, the most dangerous mafia group in Serbia.
And, let me guess, you went alone to go spy on him.
I went outside his place of business, a pool hall in the Bronyevo neighborhood. I was too scared to go in.
Fear can be a healthy thing. Keep going, I say.
When he left, I followed him to a bar, and from there he went with other men to a building near the river. I had downloaded hundreds of faces from the database of Serbian gang members, and I started matching them up.